Welcome to Understanding Congress, a podcast about the first branch of government. Congress is a notoriously complex institution, and few Americans think well of it. But Congress is essential to our republic. It's a place where our pluralistic society is supposed to work out its differences and come to agreement about what our laws should be. And that is why we are here, to discuss our national legislature and to think about ways to upgrade it so it can better serve our nation. I'm your host, Kevin Kosar, and I'm a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. The topic of this special episode of the Understanding Congress podcast is a recent book by a former Hill staffer. It is titled Fire Alarm, The Investigation of the U.S. House Select Committee on Benghazi. The author is Bradley F. Podlyska. He's an assistant professor of military and security studies at the U.S. Air Force Air Command and Staff College in Montgomery, Alabama. Brad is a retired U.S. Air Force Reserve Intelligence Officer with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He was deployed to Iraq in 2008 and also worked as an intelligence analyst for the Department of Defense. Dr. Podlyska is a former investigator for the U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee on Benghazi, and he's the author of two books, and that latter experience working on the Hill on the Benghazi Committee formed the basis for his book, Fire Alarm, The Investigation of the U.S. House Select Committee on Benghazi. Professor Podlyska, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me. I appreciate being here.
Let's hear a little bit about you before we get to our topic matter. You were an investigator for the House of Representatives. I introduced you as a professor, but I may have fooled some listeners. You were, in fact, a guy with on-the-ground experience inside Congress, investigator for the House of Representatives. For audience members who have never heard of that position, what do House investigators do, and how did you get to that position?
Certainly. So investigators are another term for it would be subject matter experts, usually based on their executive branch experience. So in my particular case, I had, I believe it was 17 years in the intelligence community and the Defense Department sectors. And so I was given that position. The role of an investigator is to interview witnesses, request documents, analyze those documents, and then provide new information back to the members for the committee so they can conduct their investigation. Now, with that said, the titles when it comes to the Benghazi Committee were completely and totally arbitrary. Attorneys had counsel in their title, and if you were a non-attorney, you either had the title of investigator, professional staff member, or advisor, but we all did the same work. So we were all analyzing documents, we were all interviewing witnesses, and then we were reporting the results to the committee members. In terms of me obtaining my position, I knew someone that had known the Republican staff director on the Benghazi Committee for over two decades. So I submitted a resume, and I was hired soon thereafter. And this is a point I actually make in my book, Fire Alarm. And that is, you're basically hired on perceived party loyalty. And this is what I refer to as a non-compensatory dimension. So in other words, merit is a secondary condition. You might be the best person for a job, but if you're not perceived as a partisan, you're not going to be hired in the first place. And the way this is done is through those personal connections that I talked about. I'm not aware of any staff member that was hired on the Benghazi committee that either didn't have prior Capitol Hill experience or did not know somebody on the committee itself.
Yes, and that should, for listeners who have heard some of the other podcasts I've done on the Congressional Research Service, Congressional Budget Office, Government Accountability Office, that's a very different thing from what happens at those legislative branch support agencies. Over there, they hire people on the basis of merit. But it's a nonpartisan hiring process, and once they are hired, they are tenured for life once they get through their one-year trial period to make sure that they're a right fit for the job. So it's a very sharp contrast. All right, this committee that employed you, we'll call it the Benghazi Committee, since the title's rather long, it's not the same thing. It was not the same thing as the typical standing committees, the ones that have lasted forever, like the Agricultural Committee and the Armed Services Committee. Where did this thing come from? How was it created, and how was it different from the usual congressional committee?
Yeah, so that's correct. This was a select committee, and it was established through a resolution for the purposes of investigating a particular issue. The resolution is going to detail the power and authority that a select committee has. And unlike a standing committee, it's not limited to a particular subject area. Now, when it comes to the Benghazi attack, the government had actually conducted 11 prior investigations prior to the setup of the Benghazi Select Committee. The FBI had conducted an investigation. State Department and County Review Board had conducted an investigation. There was 5 House committees that had conducted investigations and 4 Senate committees that had conducted an investigation. Benghazi Select Committee in particular is going to be forced into being by an outside group referred to as Judicial Watch. On April 29th, 2014, they obtained an email from Obama advisor Ben Rhodes via a FOIA request. And in that email, Rhodes is going to tell Ambassador Susan Rice that she should emphasize that the attacks were, quote, rooted in an internet video and not a broader failure of policy. Now, this email is going to force then Speaker Boehner, who at the time did not want to set up a select committee, it's going to force his hand by the conservatives and the House Freedom Caucus. The House is actually going to hold a vote on May 8th, 2014 to establish the select committee on Benghazi. It's going to be voted into being, and it's going to be given a mandate, 9 investigatory tasks that it's going to look to when it comes to the 2012 Benghazi attacks. These boil down to basically, why did the attack happen? How did the Obama administration respond to the attack? And did the Obama administration stonewall Congress in its prior investigations?
When I use the word committee, it's a bit of a black box, because not all committees, as we know, are alike. What did this special committee look like? Was it a lot of staff working for it? Was it a sprawling operation? Or was this a tight-knit little group of folks that you were with?
Generally speaking, I was a small staff. I counted 24 staff members in total. And this is going to include everybody. So 2 press secretaries, 2 executive assistants, security manager, the interns. Arguably, there's a 25th member. There's actually a reporter. The committee would link information to this reporter, and she would publish the results of this. So, you know, de facto 25. However, of this 25, there was only 15 staff members that could be identified as actually being actively involved in the investigative work of the committee. And this included the staff director, the deputy staff director, the chief counsel, and then 12 of us, the investigators, the counselors, and the advisors.
I think it's easy for people when they hear committees to sometimes think about what they see on TV, which is a bunch of legislators sitting at a dais. Maybe they see a staffer or two lurking in the back. Maybe they see a clerk tapping out notes of what's going on. But that's not all the people power that's involved. And I should, while I have you here, the legislators, how often were they working with the staff, pouring through documents? What percentage of the time were they there doing that hard work?
In general, very, very little. Now, this did vary from member to member. I actually looked at this in Fire Alarm. And so I can say that Representatives Jordan, Westmoreland, and Trey Gowdy were actively involved in the investigation. They were attending those witness interviews. They were getting briefed on a regular basis. But then we have Peter Roskam on the opposite side. He only attended 4 high-profile interviews in total. I think I saw him for a total of maybe 1 staff meeting. So simply not involved. And this is really the day-to-day activities of the committee are actually done by the staff. You're going to tee up that information for the committee members. And it's up to them on what they're going to do with it. We can get into details of when Roskam's Clinton hearing, what it looked like in terms of not being prepared. But generally speaking, it varied greatly between the members.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that the old Kip by Woodrow Wilson 120-some years ago about Congress at work being Congress in committee, it's staff in committee. That is Congress at work. Early in your book, you ask, and this is a driving question for Fire Alarm, how did a committee devoted to researching a terrorist attack on a U.S. compound in Libya turn into a conflictual partisan operation? How did that happen?
Yeah, so my central claim in Fire Alarm is that both Republicans and Democrats actually use these taxpayer-funded congressional investigations as an arena to mount political attacks for electoral advantage. This comes to actually institutional changes under Speaker Gingrich in 1995. He's going to have the committee chair selection subject to a secret party vote. He's going to make committee chairs subject to term limits, replacing the seniority factor that had been in prior. He's going to set task forces that allow an alternative legislative path to committees. He's going to cut the committee staffs by a third, effectively limiting the expertise available. And then he's going to remove the minority party from deliberations. In terms of the Benghazi committee itself, as I said, Speaker Boehner did not want to set up the committee. His hand was forced by the conservatives. And so initially, when the hiring process has been completed, he's going to do a check-the-box investigation. That is up until March 2nd, 2015. New York Times is going to publish an article that Clinton used private email. After that, and up to her hearing on October 22nd, the investigation is going to kick into high gear, going after Hillary Clinton to the exclusion of investigating the White House, intelligence community, or Defense Department. Some examples of that. So the committee is going to actually issue 36 press conferences. 26 of those releases were about Clinton. 3 were about the State Department. Absolutely none were about the White House, Defense Department, or intelligence community. The committee is going to direct 15 of its 27 document requests towards the State Department, including 5 for Clinton herself. The committee is going to produce 74,306 document pages. 72,343 of those pages are going to come from the State Department. It's going to interview 107 witnesses. Only 3 of those are from the White House. It's going to conduct 24 Defense Department interviews. 19 of those interviews are going to occur in the last 4 months of the actual investigation itself.
And for listeners who, unlike myself, was reading the papers and watching the Benghazi thing as it was unfolding all those years ago, and for those who were not like you, right there in the belly of the beast, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, right? Hillary Clinton also was being looked at as the candidate to run for in 2016 for the Democratic Party. And what happened is that this terrible terrorist attack, basically what you describe as being forged, a connection to her, and becomes a kind of vehicle of embarrassment, of referendum on her competence. And then the email thing, that was also remarkable because, yes, as you noted, while she was Secretary of State, she had set up a private server and was running communications through there, which raises its own problems. A, you're not supposed to do that. B, there are classified information policies that bind the executive branch, and as the leader of an executive agency, you're responsible for ensuring that those are obeyed. What other big factors, the background factors that should listeners know about?
Yeah, so certainly that is going to change completely the course of the investigation, because this now becomes about Clinton's emails. And so did she cause a problem and bring the attention onto herself? Arguably, absolutely, positively. And then it's going to turn out that not only that, but she has this server set up in her basement of her house, which is going to add fuel to the fire. And with that said, the investigations, I've laid out the details, goes into high gear and goes after her. So it comes down to the point here is nobody's accepting responsibility. And now it appears that Clinton is hiding things. This is going to add, as I said, fuel to the fire.
Wow. You noted that there had been things done early 90s. Newt Gingrich was speaker. Alterations to the way that the House operated. This was the first time that the Republicans had actually gained control of the House for decades. And so they were putting things under new management. They were changing how the House works. And they were making it a little more parliamentary in nature. It was much more kind of becoming a team sport exercise. When you're the majority, you stick it to the minority. You vote with the team. Don't cross the aisle unless you absolutely have to. And so you describe these kind of forces that have been building up over the years. But it wasn't inevitable, huh? The Benghazi hearings that were just so polarizing and got so ugly. It didn't have to go that way, did it?
No, absolutely not. And so going back to my earlier claim, you're hiring party loyalists to conduct this investigation. And these are not necessarily going to be the subject matter experts. They're getting their direction from Speaker Boehner's office on how to conduct this investigation. And so one of the points they make in Fire Alarm is it's evident to me that nobody actually read the witness interview transcripts after they were completed. They put together this report kind of anecdotally, and in doing so, they missed key factors that actually were more incriminating on Clinton than they actually found.
In the rush to bloody up a member of the opposite party, bloody up the person who'd become the next candidate to run for the presidency, essentially the truth got lost along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And in my book, I talk about there's actually a key meeting, interagency meeting at 7:30 p.m. on the night of the attacks. And Clinton is going to lead this meeting. She is a senior official at the meeting. And she is going to kind of, this groupthink mentality takes place that Ambassador Stevens has been taken hostage. this is going to lead the military to making a whole bunch of other mistakes and actually delaying their response for Ambassador Stevens. And Clinton, as a senior official at that meeting, instead of looking for all information that was available to her, including contradictory information, is going to say, aha, and she's actually going to read a note at the meeting, Ambassador Stevens has been taken hostage. Now, we know this is completely and totally untrue. This was a, you know, a very well-planned, well-organized terrorist assault. It later goes on to the CIA annex. But the military is going to follow her lead and basically execute a plan for hostage rescue and assume they had more time than they did. And so the CIA annex doesn't even come into their equation when it comes to the rescue. And now also at this meeting, a narrative is going to take hold also based on absolutely no evidence that this attack was due to an anti-Islamic video. And so from this meeting, Jake Sullivan is going to write talking points that are going to show up on the Sunday talk shows 5 days later, where Susan Rice is going to make that those infamous comments about this is all, you know, all due to a video that had gone awry.
It's a popular thing amongst voters to imagine that there are these kind of great and complex conspiracies that are being carried out by nefarious people in high places, and that they're very intricate, coordinated, and they can last for decades and decades and decades. That's not quite what happened here.
Well, no.
What we end up with is clusters of people playing a rough partisan game, crafting narratives on the fly to some degree, to suit their priors, to suit their purposes, adjusting them along the way, sometimes just making up stuff outright. And all the while, the media is kind of like running around and having some sort of interplay with it. It's a messy scene.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So I say you can't have a conspiracy when incompetence is the answer. And so we see officials kind of sort of doing their best, but not entirely. And then we see other officials such as Ben Rose and Jake Sullivan getting involved and putting a partisan spin on this. And then we see the Republican investigation, which is all in on Clinton and not looking at the White House, Defense Department, or intelligence community, things of that nature. And so we just have incompetence built on top of incompetence. There's no conspiracy theory to be had here. It simply comes down to people failed. And then, of course, doubling on top of that, people fail to take responsibility.
Yeah, and I guess I would underscore here, I mean, this is why books like yours are so, so important, because there was so much noise being made around this whole phenomenon of what occurred in Benghazi. It was a blur of confusion to anybody who was trying to follow it from the outside. So much information coming out, so much stuff, you didn't know if it was true, not true. So for somebody to go back and write a history and put everything together and try to explain how it played out and kind of where the facts were and where the fantasy were is a huge service. We can all learn something instead of being caught in the myths that were spun at the time. Now, you ended up leaving the committee before the whole hullabaloo was done. What happened?
Yeah, so this is actually quite interesting. So I talked about Newt Gingrich and how he had fundamentally changed Congress in 1995. He's actually going to pass what's referred to as the Congressional Accountability Act. And included in that is employment law, in particular what's referred to as USERRA. This is employment law to protect reservists that go on military service. So right as the New York Times story is breaking, literally on that day, I notified the committee I had to go on military leave. And go on military leave in two periods, one in March and then one in May. I come back and staff leadership is not talking to me. They're not giving me any investigatory work. It turns out they are very, very upset that I'd gone on leave. And then also I had not shifted to this hyper-focus on Clinton when I returned. And so about a month later, they called me in the office. They said, hey, you can either resign or you're going to be fired. I, in turn, did the lawsuit for USERRA. The whole thing blows up in the media. So ironically, Newt Gingrich did save me that. For your listeners out there, when it comes to congressional employees, if they don't like the color of your socks, they can fire you. But I, in particular, was saved because they assumed they could fire me for any reason, but they couldn't because of this Gingrich Congressional Accountability Act. And so that's what actually saved me. I think they assumed, because most congressional staffers are going to go quietly, but I had no intention of returning to the Hill. I told them at the time, I will absolutely not allow you to fire me from a military service. I will launch a lawsuit. Go ahead and do so. Now, Trey Gowdy, to his credit, He informed my attorneys he was actually going to look at all the evidence, and there's actually a staff member that presented him with evidence that exonerated me from any of their allegations, and he in turn reinstated me to the committee. He in turn signed a document stating I had not mishandled any classified information, and so I give Trey Gowdy a lot of credit for actually making things right in the end with that.
So this investigative committee, it didn't live up to what it could have been. Have you lost faith in investigative committees generally? Do you think the incentives are just so bad today that the likelihood that they're going to work out is low? Or are they still a good vehicle? And you were in the House. Is the Senate perhaps different if you wanted to speculate on that one?
So the Senate is a little bit different. I want to make the point that I'm not saying that these crises or tragedies that pop up should not be investigated. They should completely be investigated. The Senate certainly has more rules in place, more formalities in place. They actually did have a bipartisan report that came out with the Benghazi investigation. But it really comes back down to who are you employing to conduct these? You have to be a party loyalist first in order to get hired. And so I would recommend that's fine. Congress can conduct these investigations. There's going to be a partisan tint to them. However, set up these commissions, such as we have with the 9/11 Commission, the Roberts Commission with Pearl Harbor. I know they just set one up for the Afghan war. And for the audience, look at the different reports and spot what the holes in the report are. When it comes to the Benghazi Committee report, we still don't know who was in charge of Libyan policy after we read this. I think it was 989-page report. We still don't know who authored the talking points blaming this attack on an anti-Islamic video. And we know the military was slow to respond, but we don't know why the military was slow to respond. And so the more investigations, the more bipartisan investigations we get, the better.
We've about reached our time. Let me slip in one last question. To all the Hill staff who are out there listening to this podcast, or people who are aspiring to come to D.C. and work on the Hill and maybe join up on a committee, what's your advice for them?
Yeah, my advice would be to find the good representatives and senators to work for. There's plenty of them out there. With that said, Capitol Hill is very much a personality-dependent work environment. The vast majorities, they're going to be functional, they're going to be friendly, they're going to be people-oriented. Unfortunately, the Benghazi Committee was the opposite end of that spectrum. It was toxic, and I've detailed some of the behavior in the past. They set up a gun buying club in the conference room. There was Wine Wednesdays. There's a lot of surfing of the web. So avoid work environments such as that on Capitol Hill and go to the good ones. There's plenty of them out there. So I would, you know, tell any of your listeners, word travels fast on the Hill. You know, people know who the good representatives are, who the good senators are, which are the good committees to work for.
All right, Professor Bradley Pauliska, thank you so much for joining us today and educating us on investigative committees, Benghazi, life on the hills, and the promises and perils.
Well, thank you, Kevin, for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Understanding Congress, a podcast of the American Enterprise Institute. This program was produced by Jaehun Lee and hosted by Kevin Kosar. You can subscribe to Understanding Congress via Stitcher, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn. We hope you'll share this podcast with others and tell us what you think about it by posting your thoughts and questions on Twitter and tagging @AEI. Once again, thank you for listening and have a great day.